and welcome to The Logistics Tribe. I'm Boris Felgendreher, founder of The Logistics Tribe, and today we will bring the story of a brilliant mechanical engineer in his 20s named Max Olsen, who had a crazy idea of how to revolutionize container transportation on the ocean. And as you all know, over the last decade or so, container vessels have become bigger and bigger to make the transport more cost-efficient. But Max, our guest on today's program, had a totally different idea. He set out to design small, remote-controlled speedboats that hydrofoil across the water. In other words, they don't sit completely in the water, but they basically fly across the water. And those boats would carry three standard-sized ocean containers from China to the US West Coast in less than 5 days. And that's much faster than the 15 days that the journey takes with a normal container ship. How Max came up with this crazy idea, how the prototype looks like, and if his idea has any chance of becoming a viable business, all of that and more is covered in this episode of The Logistics Tribe. Super fascinating. Today's show is hosted by Jonah McIntyre. Enjoy.
Max, let's just go back in time. You and me are sitting on a park bench, and you're thinking of an idea for a new business. At that time, we were sitting there, and you said, "Hey, have you ever seen hydrofoiling like in the American Cup?" And I said, "No." And so then you started explaining it to me. Maybe you could just explain to everybody so we start with the right context. What is hydrofoiling and where might they have seen it?
You know, a hydrofoil is a wing that operates underwater and is attached to a boat, and it lifts the boat free of the water and reduces its drag and makes a very efficient and fast boat, and something that gets used extensively in sailing. It got used for a number of years for passenger craft in the sort of 70s and 80s, but has really just made a comeback in the last 10 years. And the last 10 years does make me feel a bit old. But yes, yeah, the sort of way to make much faster, much more efficient boats.
And when you say it makes boats faster and efficient, so hopefully the people who are listening to this take a second and we'll go Google hydrofoils. But when you see a boat that begins hydrofoiling, so let's start with sailboats, which is at the time, that was the only thing that I could picture in my mind when we were describing this. A sailboat that hydrofoils, it essentially is flying, right? It lifts out of the water.
Yeah, it's as close to flying as you can get without actually flying.
Yeah. Yeah, and to kind of reinforce that, you know, the first thing that goes to your mind, well, if you're not a sailor, I suppose, the first thing that goes through your mind is, well, you know, a boat's going to go as fast as the wind. But that's not the case, right?
No, these sailboats are going several times faster than the wind. Essentially, yeah, you make these boats so efficient that wind power can propel them at several times the speed of the wind.
But when we were talking about this, I think the reason that we sat down on the park bench was not because you wanted to make sailboats. You wanted to make a container ship. So you had an idea that a container ship could hydrofoil. You could take a container ship, have it go super fast, and pull it up essentially out of the water so it's skimming the water. I think you described it at the time of, imagine putting a jet engine on a container ship, and instead of it just plowing through the water, it's sort of skimming the water as it hydrofoils.
Yeah, it sort of started with a frustration for me around importing batteries. I mean, we were at the time both living in New Zealand, Jonah. In New Zealand, everything we have got here by a boat or by a plane. We were having huge issues at the company I was at importing like lithium batteries, like 18 650 cells. Essentially, there were two things going. Oh, the reason for this, sorry, is that the Galaxy Notes, you know, the phones were blowing up on planes, and suddenly there was a huge crackdown on the shipping of lithium batteries. And yeah, so it was a huge issue. And essentially, there were two ways. I started talking to the suppliers, and there were two ways you could get batteries into New Zealand. One was, you know, waiting 10 weeks, putting them in a container, putting them in the belly space of a container ship, well out of direct sunlight, where it's nice and temperature stable, and shipping them as dangerous goods that way. And the other way was to put them in an email packet and lie and don't tell anyone that there were batteries in there and hope that nobody realized. But because the supply was limited, it was the sort of like this game of, were you cool enough and were you good enough friends with the supplier that they would lie on your behalf? And did they want to wear that risk for you? And so, yeah, it became this quite weird game where you had to befriend the supplier for them to lie on your behalf to bring batteries in and sell them to you, which was quite a big shift compared to what we were used to.
And for context of anyone, you know, here who are listening, it's not like you were a battery wholesaler, right? You were in another line of business and you simply wanted batteries to run your other product business, which we can talk about later. And so so having these options, you had air and ocean. Ocean, obviously, much, much slower as well, especially for New Zealand. In the New Zealand context, that's not a primary trade lane. So that's not a laneway where you have the, you know, the boats departing every day in both directions. So how did you get from that to, yeah, I'm going to build a speedboat. I'm going to build a speedboat using technology that's sort of known and known. I mean, one of the things I want to talk about in a second is you mentioned hydrofoils have sort of been known for a while, and there were some commercial hydrofoiling vessels in the 70s or 80s. But no one who's listening to this podcast is going to have ridden on one of those, I think. So, you know, what was the key thing that made it possible then? Then people stopped, and now you say, or you said at the time, hey, let's build these jets on the water.
Yeah, at the time, and I try to minimize this in my head, I think, but you know, the reality was that the America's Cup was on at the time, and the America's Cup is a battle of hydrofoiling yachts. You know, it's the oldest sporting trophy in the world, I think. And you know, it was kind of this like moment of, you know, how efficient are these boats? So what had happened is hydrofoils were huge in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and they're as old as time. You know, so Alexander Graham Bell held the water speed record on a hydrofoil in like 1908.
That's so check
that
awesome.
One as well, please.
That's awesome.
So yeah, like that's oh, it's a while ago. And then they made this big suit. It was sort of like this early, a whole bunch of old-timey inventors went and played around on hydrofoils, died, came back 60s, 70s into like military, and then Boeing made a hydrofoil that operates Hong Kong, Macau. Some of your listeners might have ridden on one of those.
Oh, yeah.
I rode on them.
Yeah.
Like growing up, and I grew up, for, you know, spent 4 years in Hong Kong. And I remember the hydrofoils there. But essentially the theory was, you know, we can build the hydrofoil. The hydrofoils themselves and the boats were like entirely aluminium. They're made out of like giant either CNC cut or like folded plate aluminium hydrofoils. The shapes they could produce of the foils themselves, or like the wing profiles, were, you know, just like glorified rectangles. And they did, you know, for the tools of the time, like, my word, incredible designs that they pulled together. But they were heavy, they weren't very efficient, and they sort of compensated by just, you know, well, let's go grab a gas turbine from a plane and put it on there, and we'll just, if we just pour enough Jet A1 at it, the boat will go.
And I think here it's probably because for many of the podcast listeners, they don't come from a heavy engineering background. And just to reiterate, in case you haven't yet Googled what the heck is a hydrofoiling boat, you know, you're talking about, when you say the wings, I mean, it literally is, when I picture these hydrofoiling boats, it literally is a normal boat. Then it's got a kind of a stilt.
A strut.
Yeah, a strut. Exactly. A strut that goes into the water, maybe at multiple points for stability. And then under the water, it's got these wings like an airplane. And you're describing the wing shape because, like in the airplanes, the flow dynamic around the wings must be extremely important for efficiency and lift and everything. You are essentially flying through water, but with, I presume, like much less drag because you don't have the hull on the rough surface of the water dealing with the waves and everything. You've got this wing shape attached to a strut that's below that choppy surface that's moving through through the water. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually that's an excellent description. Yeah, and yeah, the dynamics are exactly like a wing through the air, but because your water is 1,000 times denser than the air, the wing is 1,000 times smaller. So you get away with a very small wing creating a lot of lift, and yeah, and it sits below the water, and it makes, yeah, like a fast boat, an efficient boat, and you clear, you know, most of your drag on a boat at, you know, doing 35 knots plus 60 kilometers per hour. You know, at that speed, at 60 kilometers per hour, you get most of your drag on the boat comes from skin friction, you know, like the friction between the hull of the boat and the water. So yeah, you say you lift that boat clear of the water and suddenly it's got a lot less drag. You just have this very small foil running beneath the water and a really small sort of surface of influence between the water and the foil and the rest of the boat. And so yes, sits up on stilts that we call struts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's sort of go back, let's get the trajectory here. So this is 2017. So we sit on this park bench. And a couple of things that really struck me, and you know, one of the reasons I want to call out your sort of origin story here is for the 3 years afterwards, 4 years now, after that, when people had asked me, oh, what's something interesting happening in supply chain? What's an interesting startup that I should take a look at? I brought your startup up. I mean, yours was the go-to name for me. And so here are the reasons why, and then we'll move on. The first is the startup world is chock-a-block full with software attacking some space which was previously done manually or partially by software. You know, that's sort of 99.9% of the startups. When we sat down, you wanted to build a big boat and you didn't really know what you're going to do with the boat, right? Like that I found fascinating, where you sort of had this view of, well, I think I can build this boat, and if I could, wouldn't that be commercially interesting? But that was a question mark. Like, wouldn't that be commercially interesting, right? And then the second thing that was fascinating about this potential startup is that even the hardware startups in supply chain tend to be RFID devices. They tend to be sortation devices in warehouses, material handling kit, or maybe self-driving trucks. All of which are sort of small kits applied to a large, you know, a large device. This is more like the equivalent of building a new airplane or building an entirely new form of transport with profound consequences for the supply chain space, which I also want to talk about in a second. So just to close off this origin story, when you decided to do it, what was the sequence of things you wanted to prove out between I have an idea and this will be a viable business?
Like all good hardware startups, it started with a spreadsheet of, you know, how efficient does the boat have to be to split the difference between, you know, sea freight and air freight. And that's where I was positioning the business, was air freight, too much regulation, too much cost, you know, great for speed. Sea freight, the Wild West. As I found out more and more as I sort of dug into the market of building these boats, and, you know, but regulation light and very low cost, and, you know, what is the sort of the bounds of the engineering problem that make this a viable alternative somewhere between those two options? And, you know, for me, I'm a mechanical engineer, and I was like, well, here's the bounds. Does a hydrofoil sit between them? Yeah, a hydrofoiling boat is something I could build. And then from spreadsheet, who do I know in the freight game? Jonah, my next door neighbor.
So maybe now if we could turn, because most of the Logistics Tribe listeners, right, they come from a logistics background, and this is where I think this starts to get really fascinating. So let's just play out, let's play with the consequences for a second. Let's play out what it would look like. Your boat, how many containers would it carry? So
we were talking about 3 40-foot containers.
Got it. So 3 40-foot containers on a boat that would be able to give me some sort of transit time expectation from, say, China to the US.
Yeah, so it's sort of like 45 knots. You could get, Shanghai to LAX and, it's like 5 days, just absolutely okay. Shoot across the ocean.
Because emissions is becoming quite important in the industry. The intention of these were battery operated, right?
No, initially it was diesel. There was no way to get battery across that sort of distance. But if you're worried about emissions, don't put it on a plane, put it on a hydrofoiling boat.
Got it. Oh, sorry, last point. Given that it's 3 containers, it's presumably a much smaller boat. That means it doesn't need to go to a major port like Long Beach, right? It can be unloaded at potentially much, much smaller ports.
Yeah,
right?
we were running, and we still are actually, in what we do at the moment, is that you run an infrastructure light business. So you're not reliant on, big ports. We could use secondary ports and the sort of like then the winner takes all structure that ports were sort of developing with, bigger cranes, more wharf space to accept larger boats. We could make use of the smaller ports, right down to, a remote jetty would be enough to load one of these little 3 container mm-hmm. ships. We don't need the depth. We don't need the wharf length. We don't need the big cranes. Mm-hmm. It's air freight on the water.
For the audience, the people who are listening who come from logistics background, I'm hoping that lights are kind of going off in their mind now. This was the other reason, besides just the boldness of the vision of, hey, I'm going to build a business around this new enormous piece of hardware, and if it works, there's great commercial applications, and if it doesn't work, of course, then we won't do it. The other thing that I found super fascinating about your business, Max, was that this would entirely disrupt and change the dynamics of ocean container shipping, because ocean container shipping has been at this race to economy of scale where you build greater and greater capacity vessels until they totally max out the canal paths at like Panama or Suez. So you end up with super ports served by super boats, which are fighting each other in kind of a price war to consolidate the industry. And then you come along and say, as quite an outsider, right, say, hey, I think I'm going to make a speedboat, that can take 3 containers to any port, and it'll do it at a fraction of air freight costs at a transit time that's just a bit longer than air freight. Very fascinating. Can you just, real quick, talk about how you would have, in your mind, how you're thinking about these would be deployed? Because you essentially were thinking swarms, right? You were thinking very large volumes of these boats.
Yeah, I think a thing to dig into there is that a traditional non-hydrofoiling boat runs on, what we'd call a cube law, where if you double the length of a boat, the volume of the boat goes up by 2 to the power of 3, but the surface area of the boat, which is most of the drag, goes up by 2 to the power of 2. And so the volume in the boat escapes the drag. And so inevitably the boats get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's also some crewing, considerations in there, but, just in sort of an energy in, energy out basis, really big displacement, when I say displacement, non-hydrofoiling boats make sense from a fuel perspective. Hydrofoiling breaks that relationship. If you double the weight you're carrying, you also double your drag. So suddenly you don't have this escape of, volume and weight away from efficiency. And so small boats make equally as much sense as large boats. And then if we sort of cast our minds into the future and we think about the prospects of autonomous ships, and then so crewing requirements no longer dictate the efficiency of boats, or the economic efficiency of boats. And then we have the situation where very large swarms of boats performing point-to-point operations with relatively small payloads in a very efficient way on hydrofoils starts to look like this whole new way to move freight around the world.
Mm-hmm. Uncrewed, autonomous, hydrofoiling little container ships, you know, three containers or something, zipping around in point-to-point moves. So not in a traditional container boat's path where it would try to call on multiple ports to load and unload in a kind of a rotational sequence. Your boats would be going essentially direct, right? You don't have a crew manning those three containers. It's a review station someplace that's manning 100 of the boats in remotely by watching them.
Absolutely. Yeah, you start with a crewed boat. A human is a fairly cheap computer to get going.
Yeah, I believe NASA used to, in the 50s, NASA used to describe the cheapest 150-pound mass-produced computer and robot was a human being.
You start with a crude system, and then if you can change the fuel in, energy out relationship, and you can change the crew in, service out relationship, suddenly you can build large swarms of small boats instead of doing hub and spoke. I believe was the term you were looking for, searching your mind for, really digging deep, and turning it into a point-to-point service, trying to cut down on times and create efficiencies, you know, beyond just the hydrofoil, creating efficiencies and just taking things where they actually need to go instead of near where they need to go.
Yeah, seems and still seems like a great thing to do.
Yeah, I'm getting hyped by it now. So then that was 2017. In the intervening years, you began to build out demonstration versions of the hardware that was necessary. Just for the sake of time, can you identify one or two sort of key moments that for you in the as you were building out kind of first a prototype version then a larger prototype version, etc.?
Key moment, I came to you, Jonah, to talk me out of what I was about to do, and you failed. In fact, you just encouraged me, emboldened me to carry on. And so, built.
Which should be a lesson to anybody, right? I actually say this in all seriousness. Other people around you will encourage you to do stupid businesses, really. Like, I've had this experience where you go to people and say, I'm thinking about starting the business, and they're like, oh, you should do that. You should follow your dreams. That's a great idea. And then, you know, when you start the business and you go back to them and say, hey, you know, maybe be a customer, and they're going, I don't think I really need that. And you go, well, hey, like, 6 months ago when I bought you lunch, you said it was a great idea. So you got convinced to do it. And then what was the next big milestone?
There's messiness in the middle, but if we could just cut to, I raised a small seed round to go and build, you know, the first prototype, which was at like a 1/10 scale. It was this crazy little boat, which we affectionately knew as Bearfish. It was roughly 3.5 meters long. You know, the 1/10 scale would then make that 35 meters long at full scale. It was driven by electric motors, developed their own flight controller. You built a flight controller to stabilize it. It used a tandem foil setup, which is like you have two foils which are identical and they're directly in line. And then it balances a lot like a motorcycle or a bicycle, where it sort of just, you know, steers itself to keep it upright. It looked absolutely unreal on the water. It was incredible. We scared a lot of locals out on the local harbors when we were out testing it. And it totally worked, and it worked exactly as we expected it to. And so that was sort of prototype.
Yeah, for people listening, try to imagine you go out on your boat sailing someday, and then a joyful pack of like young people come by with a 3.5 meter long hydrofoiling remote control boat that's going at presumably pretty fast, right?
Yeah, like a good clip, like 30 plus knots, you know, so you're talking, you know, 55 k's an hour, which is fast on the water. You know, that doesn't feel that fast in your car, but something of sort of that size that's remote controlled, like, yeah, we used to, you know, joke about, you know, the punters being out in their fishing boats, and there'd be this sort of thing on the water that looked vaguely like a submarine. And then sort of stop by, and for some reason they didn't think, hey, I should keep my distance from this thing. They thought, hey, I'll see how close I can get to this to see what it is. And so we did take great pleasure in just absolutely launching it out of the water onto its hydrofoils. What some might not consider to be a safe distance from these punters.
I love it.
We've grown. We have matured since.
Yeah, it's a 3.5 meter like hydrofoiling remote control boat going really fast. It must be really cool. So okay, so you got through the 1/10 scale, and then what came next?
Yep, another scale model. So that was 1/10. We went to 1/4. So it's a so the 1/10 scale was sort of 200 kilograms, 3.5 meters. It went to, we had a revisit. We used all the data we captured from that prototype and said, you know, what's the sensible way to build this boat? So we went from a monohull boat to a small catamaran. We built it at 6 meters long, 1 ton. And changed the foil layout from a tandem layout to a canard layout. Maybe you've got some engineers in the mix here who would understand those things, but essentially a canard layout is a large foil near the aft of the boat and a smaller hydrofoil at the front that acts as the sort of stabilizer to the whole system, which is a reasonably efficient way to build a hydrofoil whilst retaining stability. So we sort of revisited, we learnt, took what we'd learnt, took the data and made a much larger prototype at this 1/4 scale.
Okay, so now you're really scaring your neighbors. You've got a 1-ton 6-meter plus remote control speedboat that you're zipping around in. And I think, because you've got a pivot coming here, What was the moment when the pivot started to become clear? So for people who are like listening in and thinking, what do you mean a pivot? Well, today you're not still focused on container transport. You're looking at roll-on and passenger ferries. And so can you just describe how that shift in focus, because it sounds like you got through two stages of pretty hard engineering.
Yeah, so I think like there's a few things that happened. One is that all of our prototypes were electric, and we fell in love with building electric hydrofoils. So on a technology front, we actually got very good at building these electric boats, and suddenly the thought of putting diesel on the boats seemed a lot less like what we should be doing. Two, I mean, the supply chain scene and international freight right now is very different than it was sort of 9 months ago, 12 months ago when we were making this switch. So I will only describe it in the ways that it looked at the time. Margins were very thin. When we were talking to, you know, the customers that we would roll out with, one of the huge overarching concerns was like resilience of the network. And so to have a single boat operating on a 1,000-kilometer route running twice a day, or sorry, once a day, was actually not substantially better. So what we were realizing is that we needed several boats operating from day dot to create a service that people wanted. The routes were long. The certification process was very hard. We had to burn diesel to get it done. There was a lot pointing towards a capital intensive project to go from our current prototype to our operational model. And there was a lot of unproven ground to cover.
You'd be a capital intensive company, in a capital intensive industry, but you'd be against people who are capital heavy, you know, people who are either state backed, like some of the Asian lines, or you would be against people like Maersk, who are, you know, a significant fraction of a country's economy at their headquarters.
Yeah,
it would
absolutely
be tough, right?
Immense.
Absolutely. And the margins of that business were enough to make it work, but they weren't enough to necessarily, as like a starting point to break in. They weren't there.
Yeah.
Margins were just too thin to make it all put together. And then, yeah, so occasionally I would shake my fist at our initial conversation, Jonah, and say, you know, why didn't you tell me this?
Why in the world did Jonah make it sound positive? I believe in our conversation my view was, you can work out the commercials later. If you can make such a boat, you can either sell it to those companies, you can start your own shipping line, or you can license the design. But then again, I just go back to my earlier comment, never trust the bystander opinion. You know, bystanders are like, yeah, that would be really exciting.
If you had convinced me not to do it, you would have also been wrong. So either way, you were wrong and I was right. So yeah, and so we started looking at this. We'd obviously made huge inroads on the technology. We'd built our own flight controllers. We'd built our own hydrofoils. Like we were a small startup team laying up our own carbon fiber hydrofoils and building our own actuators and programming flight computers. Building electrical systems, building battery packs and motors, and like we were pretty across the board doing a lot of stuff. Fairly multi-talented.
Yeah, so you built, I mean, what was interesting about the moment of your pivot was, as any good startup, it was not an abandonment of the entirety, right, what you'd been working on. You had sequentially validated hypotheses you had, for example, can we build such a boat, right? You had sequentially validated those things, and you had established expertise and sort of resource and skill and intellectual property within your team. You just found a stronger business. So maybe tell us about what that business focus is right now.
Right. So right now we're building Ropax ferries, you know, car ferries, again, relatively small at 40 meters long, carrying 20 cars and 150 passengers across routes up to 200 kilometers in length. And yeah, that was the big change. So what we realized is some of these Ropax routes have, you know, running them with a hydrofoiling high-speed ferry is a good margin business. And you can start with a single boat. We could start locally here in New Zealand, and we could reuse a lot of this technology that we'd been building and had gotten really good at building, and turn it into something that was actually, you know, far more consumer focused, something that excited people, something that excited our employees. And yeah, so it went from being like quite hard to sort of develop the business towards the market to being very easy. Things that were coming, you know, hard fought wins were becoming easy wins. And essentially around this shift to Ropax ferries, we started building the most incredible team. And for some reason, the thought of putting cars and passengers on an electric hydrofoil and it riding 4 meters above the waves on these long struts or stilts, as you describe them, captures people's imaginations far more than a freight ship. Offensive?
No, it's not offensive. So that's the irony of the logistics industry, is that it permeates and supports the entire economy, but it's, for all intents and purposes, it's ignored by everyone who uses it. And that's okay. You know, I ignore, for example, the plumbing in my house, the fact that it delivers me clean water on demand at the temperature I want it. That's a good thing. That was a problem that was solved by society a long time ago, and I don't have to think about it, so I can go on to solve the next set of problems. And I think logistics is right at the cusp of that. Of most people don't think, the industry participants think about it, most people don't think about it and you're not hiring logicians, you're hiring engineers, you're hiring commercial salespeople, they can get excited about a ferry that their friends and their family can ride on. You know, like you said, huge ferry, right? For you're talking about, you're taking orders right now for 40 meter long ferries that are going to ride 4 meters above the water, above the waves, and like zip across. Cool, right? I can understand how engineers get excited about that. Yeah. Just to kind of close things off, maybe talk about the state of your business right now. You mentioned you had a great team. Tell us a little bit about that. And then we can kind of close with, from your perspective, do you think that future, that container shipping side, is that something that is sort of just ruled out for you? Is that something you think someone else will do, but it's sort of, you know, someone else's mission? Is it just not the right time, but the engineering will eventually make it so? What's your perspective there?
When I was starting this business, I was lusting after, you know, the engineers that made these America's Cup yachts. Mm-hmm. And then in the last sort of 6 months, we've been from, you know, gone from a company that lusted after such engineers to a company that hired them. So now we are a team of engineers who come from, you know, Emirates Team New Zealand, from American Magic, another syndicate, Oracle Racing, Virgin Hyperloop. Mm-hmm. We've got people who, you know, built electric ferries already. We've got project manager from, you know, the Apple Watch. We have this most like incredible team who all just absolutely driven to turn the vision into reality. We hired the, you know, the first engineer at Wish, who is atoning for his sins in selling very low quality goods by building very high quality boats. So that's like, that's been a massive change. In terms of will we be back to freight? Yeah, we're building these 40 meter hydrofoiling car ferries at the moment, and that's awesome. And yeah, that's a $35 billion plus market to tackle for us. But eventually the technology will become such that, you know, our original hypothesis around this freight market will become viable again, as far as we're concerned at the moment. We've got a lot of work to do in the ropax space. I think we can make it, you know, the most immense impact on providing, you know, high speed, emissions free, incredibly comfortable transport floating above the waves. And so we're totally focused there right now.
Yeah, it's super exciting. I have to say, just to close off, it's also personally super exciting to see how you've developed this potential business and the amazing things I think you're going to get up to in the rest of your career. So for people who've been listening to this, they're probably thinking, this is a very much a mid to late career engineer. If you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 28 years old. I have thus far failed to have a real job outside of university. So I left university and was at Holter building dairy cow collars, left there and have since been running Sea Change.
It's amazing. I appreciate you coming on. I know I learned a lot. The story is sort of only at the beginning. There's a lot more to be said.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Jonah. Great to talk.
All right. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
All right. That was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Max Olson, the CEO and founder of Sea Change. I hope you enjoyed today's show. If so, please subscribe to the Logistics Tribe podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Fergendreher. Until next time.